Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
It is not Rick Moore. Rick Moore gets to take the day off. It is Sean McCord, his reliable substitute host here on this Easter Sunday. Happy Easter, everybody. And I actually mean that sincerely. We're going to be bringing up a very interesting topic, something that's near and dear to me. So this Sunday, I will not be portraying the dispassionate journalist peppering my guests with questions. I'm going to be very much a part of this conversation because today we have a couple of new friends of mine, that I connected to through the Virginia Atheist and Agnostics. And we're going to talk about what it means to be a non-believer in a not entirely secular society. And one of the things we want to do is sort of talk about terms. I mean, let's start off talking about terms. Let me introduce my guests. You're sharing a microphone, so we're going to have to ask you to get nice and cozy with each other. And Scott Skokowski, did I mangle your last name, Scott?
No, you did it pretty well.
Okay, all right. That's good. And if you can get even closer, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Carolyn Florinai.
Good morning.
Good morning to both of you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for getting so close to each other while you share our single microphone. But, hey, it's community radio. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC. I had to remember to say that a few times. 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And we're going to be talking about atheism, agnosticism, non-theism, lack of belief. And let's start with terms here, as we were talking a little bit before going on the air. A few years ago, finally embraced the term atheist. I don't particularly like it because it's trying to define something by a negative, it's trying to define something by what I'm not. Like, for example, I don't actually believe in leprechauns either. It was St. Patrick's Day recently. I don't actually believe in leprechauns, but I don't have to call myself a leprechaun-nastic.
A leprechaunist.
A leprechaun? Right. So what term do we use? Do you have a preferred term? Scott, you want to go first?
I guess for me, I tend to eschew the use of the label just because I prefer to have the conversation.
Right.
But so I wouldn't necessarily have a preferred term.
Yeah, the thing is, there is not another term out there.
Right.
So I could sort of stumble through and you know, explain to people, or I could just say, yeah, I'm an atheist, whatever.
Yeah.
Carolyn, do you have thoughts?
Right, exactly. Technically, I'm an agnostic because you can't prove a negative, right?
Right.
But no one knows what agnostic means. They think it means they really seize on the agnostic part.
Right, like you're waffling.
Right. And it's like, No, we'll just go with atheist.
Right. So, but I will confess, I'm rather agnostic about my own atheism.
Right.
So assuming that we don't have people snapping off the radio because they can't bear to hear this conversation right now, my goal in this hour is to talk about how you can lead a really good life without belief in the superstitious, and really that's what it comes down to for me. We'll get into our biographies in a second. I can tell you that for me, this is just the way I was wired from the beginning. I honestly believed in Santa Claus longer than I believed in God. Now, part of it was because I was brought up in a non-church going household, so I wasn't sort of dipped like Achilles, you know, into the deep broth of religiosity.
Mixed metaphor there.
Thank you very much. My dad had been raised highly Catholic by his stepmother, sent to Catholic schools, full expectation that he was going to become a Catholic priest. And as I told you earlier, every time he had a question, they referred him to another passage of the Bible, which just raised three more questions. And eventually he discovered he had more questions than there were answers, and he left the church. My mother, I think her parents grew up, I don't, I, you know what, honestly don't remember. It's like Anglican and Methodist or something like that. So when they brought their kids up, they went to sort of went to church, but they didn't. So by the time I came along, we had our Sunday free to watch football. So I wasn't immersed in that. Now different people are going to respond to that differently. With me, it perfectly fit my worldview. I have an older brother, I have an older sister, and for a while they sort of explored religious alternatives themselves, especially when they had children. So let's first of all talk about that. Give a little bit of your own biography that kind of brought you to where you are now. Scott, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah. So I was actually, I did attend a Catholic school when I was younger. But for me, I was never really in a religious household. It was always very, my parents never really forced it on me. I'm fairly certain that my father was religious, but my mother wasn't, and we have talked about it since now that I'm a little bit older with her. So my upbringing was fairly secular, and in terms of my own come to this particular conclusion was just that, kind of similar to what you said, is that I was just very inquisitive, and I just had a lot of questions, and a lot of times when I would ask those questions, it would just bring up more, and that was just, that got me started on the track, and then just kind of led to where it is now.
And Carolyn, you took a more complicated journey.
Right. So I was raised without any form of sort of explicit religious exposure. I mean, certainly back in the generations, my family has clergy people, and it's clear that I have relatives to whom faith is an important dimension of their life. But my household was not that way growing up. I think each of my parents are probably somewhere between the atheist and agnostic. Like, at most, they might be deists, and the fact that I don't really know signifies we didn't really talk about
it. So you see it as a spectrum.
As a spectrum. In my early teens, I was very interested in ways of life and what is the question of how to live a good life. Mm-hmm. And the only game in town, well, I should say this was the Shenandoah Valley in the 1980s and 90s, and the only game in town was fundamentalist Christianity. So I started by reading the Bible and was interested in it as a sort of a literary thing and flatly horrified by some of it as an ethical thing. But if you've read the Bible and you're interested in this kind of thing and you talk about it at school, I ended up getting invited to go to church. And I went to church and eventually decided that I would become a Christian. And so I did. And I believe that I was as sincere in my faith as any Christian is.
So talk a little bit about that, because I noticed you hesitate when you said become a Christian. What was that like for you? Did you have a revelation?
That is such a good question, and I feel like that really just comes down to just the very heart of all these questions about what it means to be religious, how you know whether or not you're an atheist,
right?
How you know whether, you know, and how you would possibly assess someone else's faith, because I think that is what a lot of the extremism, a lot of the anxiety around religion is driven by. It's this belief that, oh, well, I, as a Christian, I have to believe these things, and if the people around me maybe don't believe them, that introduces a level of just insecurity that then promotes policing of other people's beliefs. It also, interestingly, it promotes a kind of a perpetual insecurity in yourself about the state of your soul. And so repeat conversion experiences are very common, actually, in the evangelical Christian community. And then it's a question of, well, what happened that first time around? Why didn't that take, right? What does that mean that you have to do it again? Because you're not supposed to have to do it again. If you're saved, you're saved.
Right.
So I guess what I mean by it was that I understood it as a leap of faith. I certainly wasn't convinced in an intellectual way of things like the literal creation of the entire universe in 7 days and whatnot.
Days,
right, exactly.
Right.
I never believed any of that. And I also always simply found it repugnant, some of the beliefs that are taken to be very important to the faith in this evangelical Christian community, things like, I can't even tell you the things that were said about gay people in that place and time.
Sure.
And I always
You don't have to. I've got a good
imagination. Right, I'm sure you do, and I'm sure all our listeners do as well. And I never could see the connection. It's like, why is it so necessary, you know, if we're getting down to credo in unum deum, right? What in the world does it matter what other people do, right? But I understood it as a leap, and like it's almost like falling in love. It's you want to see something here. You want to see something in the Christian myth.
That is such a good analogy, and I want to get back to that in a moment. Like falling in love, but carry on.
Right, right. And you want to believe that this is the thing that will make you whole, right? And this touches a little bit on this, I find somewhat condescending, this thing that gets said about atheists having a God-shaped hole in their conception, in their yeah. lives or yeah. whatever, yeah. yeah. And I would say it's not exactly like that. I'm not exactly endorsing that. But I was 14, 15, 16. I was very concerned with questions of what should be my goal in life. What should I be doing? Because I had this terrible sense of sin that I was doing the wrong thing. And how was I going to find the right thing other than to keep asking these questions, keep pushing out, keep finding out who are the people who are leading good lives? And what I really was in search of in that time, I would say, with the benefit of retrospect, was philosophy. Mm-hmm. But there was no philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
There was religion.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about atheism, agnosticism, non-theism with my guests, Scott Skakowsky and Carolyn Flournoy. Scott, I'm just, if I can get through this rest of the show without mangling your name too much, I'll have accomplished some things.
Yeah, that'd be good.
I wanted to get back to that that metaphor you talked about, Caroline, about falling in love, because there's a really great line from the movie Contact.
Mm,
remember
yes.
that? Help me out. What's the actress's name?
Oh, well, the character's name is Arroway.
Right.
Jodie Foster.
Thank you. Jodie Foster is a scientist, and they may be contacting an alien civilization for the first time, and she's also a skeptic, and she's talking with another character, and they actually, in the middle of this movie about contacting alien life, they're talking about God. And she expresses her skepticism about God because she says, how can you prove it? And the other character turns to her and says, do you love your father? And she says, well, yes. And he says, prove it. Because it is an emotional connection. And this is something that, you know, I did see early on growing up. You know, I grew up, I told you about my family, but, you know, my friends went to church. My best friend had catechism. You know, I had relatives who were brought up Catholic. And they would talk about this sense of love and this sense of connection that they had with an external being. And I kind of got it when I was a kid, because when I was a kid, I saw life all around me. You know, I used to say goodnight to the furniture in my room because I was, and it was really important to me to say goodnight to all the pieces of furniture in my room because I didn't want one of them to have, you know, to feel insulted if I forgot them. I mean, you know,
that's
things,
really cute.
These are the things you do when we're little kids because we see sort of life around us, and we sort of feel, you know, a connection to sort of everything around us. And I apologize for the ways this is going to sound, but I grew out of it. And when I learned to be less self-centered and more sort of empathetic to other people and see other people's point of view, I found this strange dichotomy. It's like, okay, I understand, you know, I can sort of stand in somebody else's shoes now, and I can be empathetic to someone else's situation, but there was this sort of last connection that I couldn't make, this idea that there was this ethereal, sort of spiritual presence watching us, guiding us, sort of nudging us along and affecting our lives in different ways. I just didn't buy it. And that's where I come to now. You know, when I get in discussions with people who are religious and they say, well, you know, how can you prove there is no God? I think, well, I can't any more than you can prove that there is one.
There is, right.
But to me, what it comes down to is I doubt it. I just don't buy it.
Right.
And it's not, you know, there are people, I've heard arguments on the internet and Facebook, because that's where we do all of our communicating these days. You know, I've seen the argument, I'm sure you have too, that says atheism is a religion. because atheism is based on faith. Do you have a response to that, Scott? Have you seen those conversations?
The first thing I was going to say was that the idea of the proof and the substantiating evidence for the claim, I do I have come up against that one quite often, and that does strike me as a fallacy in the sense that it's on the person who is making the claim first to present the evidence in favor of that claim.
Right. Carl Sagan said extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Exactly. Right. And so it's like I could come up with anything at the moment and then say there's like a unicorn at my house back home, right? And then you say, I don't believe that. And it's like, prove that there isn't. You know, and again, that's another Carl Sagan thing. He talked about the dragon in his garage.
Right.
And that was the exact thing. So I have heard those things before. I'm sorry, but could you repeat the other thing that you asked me?
That atheism is just another form of faith.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, I don't, you know, again, I think that that's just, we were talking earlier about language mm-hmm. and how language can kind of be mixed up in this case. And I think that that's just a way of people trying to make it seem like they can say that, if we are guilty of these things, then by you believing in that thing, if it's also a religion, then you're guilty of all those things as well, right? And I don't buy that, because I don't think that rejecting a claim that has no evidence is the same as building up an entire doctrine around a claim and then claiming to live your life around that, you know?
Right. And it's a different kind of faith. I call it faith not with a capital F. Like, I have faith that the sun's going to come up tomorrow morning, because it always has, mm-hmm. and because we sort of understand the laws of celestial physics and all that. Mm-hmm. So, but that's a small F faith. Yeah. I don't have faith that when I die, my soul is going to ascend to some other heavenly presence, mm-hmm. because, I just don't buy it. And if you examine it, there is no evidence for it. So the only way that I've seen to believe something like that is to just believe it because you want to, or because that's how you've been raised. Carolyn, I see you nodding.
Yeah.
Your head. You have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, so this idea of that you can just believe, that you can somehow make yourself do that.
Uh-huh.
I may have misunderstood this because I was never Catholic, but the two of you with your Catholic school background, you can probably set me straight here. My understanding is that the question of free will, as it's specifically related to this experience of conversion, was a huge preoccupation of the scholastics, who were the Christian thinkers of the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads to a conception of free will that actually is very much still how we think of free will. This idea that the will is almost magical. You can make something happen by willing it to be. Mm-hmm.
Like the Force.
Well, maybe. I don't know. I guess, actually, I haven't thought of the Force as an example of sort of Christian, philosophy. But obviously, it doesn't come from nowhere, right?
Right.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
yeah. but that specifically about...
you were talking about the scholastics.
Yes, the scholastics, right. Sorry. That you can make yourself believe something, that you are responsible for I want to say the product of your will, but that isn't quite what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
That, but basically, this idea that the God is fundamentally just; He wouldn't set us up this impossible thing where there really are people like us who can't believe. The idea is that everyone can believe, but that at some level it's a choice, and it's important that it be a choice so that we can then deserve the outcome, whether it's salvation or damnation. Right? You have to get into considerably later stuff, the Calvinists, before you come up to a place where, maybe you can't believe, and maybe that's your fate.
Well, and that is actually going to be my question. I'll continue with you, Carolyn. Did you choose to become a non-believer or a skeptic or whatever
right.
word you want to
right,
use?
Right. No, so this is interesting because these are not mirror forms. I chose to become a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I recognized that I was an atheist.
Mm. Right. So I know we talked about this, but if in a perfect world, do you have a preferred term?
Oh,
for whatever it is we are?
Oh, golly.
I mean, I like skeptic.
Right.
Mm. Personally.
So, yes, but I think skepticism, and this gets to something that you were saying about the unicorns and everything, is that, again, people who are believers don't understand what non-belief is like. And so you get a couple of very strange models for it. You get the assumption that we must either be radical skeptics mm-hmm. in like a Descartesian sense, right? And so you're not allowed any faith. And if you have any faith in anything, such as that the sun will come up tomorrow, now suddenly you're not an atheist. Suddenly you don't qualify. Now you're a member of your own religion. It's just not their religion, right? Or you get this thing that they... that, and I don't want to use words like they because it seems so dehumanizing, but something I experienced as a child in school before my religious conversion was people didn't understand what it was to not believe. And so I got believed to be a Satanist, which I thought was so strange.
Oh yeah. Let's get back to Satanism because I love that. Just a second. But this is community radio, and we do have to sell our soul to our corporate underwriters on WPVC 94.7.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
Okay, so you brought up Satanism, and this is kind of the fun side of being non-theist. So there have been a number of reports of towns or high schools. I read one the other day. I don't remember where the high school was, where the library put Bibles by the front door, and the students came in to check out library books. And on the way out, the librarian was standing there by the table full of Bibles, not picking them up and handing them to each kid, but said, "Here's a free book. Take one on the way out," and the teacher encouraged him. And there was one little girl who reportedly didn't, and then was kind of pressured by her peers. "What's the matter with you? Why don't you want to take a Bible? It's free." And the school said, "Well, this was legal. They weren't distributing them to unwilling students. They were just putting them there in the library for students to pick up on the way out." And it sounds, on the face of it, benign. You know, who wouldn't want a free Bible? But then, because the school allowed this, and they actually, and the it went to the school board, and their attorney said, "Yeah, this is allowable." So a local group of Satanists asked permission to put out Satan's coloring book. I don't know if you've seen this thing.
It's like, no,
yes,
I'm imagining it must
yes,
be really exciting.
Yes, it's like Fun with Satan.
Right.
And the whole point was, and the whole point of this group that's doing it is not because they want to convert kids to Satanism. I mean, they've said right out, "We would rather the schools didn't distribute our literature, but if they're going to be right. distributing any literature at all, then they need to distribute this at all. It's, you know, they need to distribute this as well." Kind of shaking things up. So that's kind of the fun side of atheism, but it's unfortunate because then I think a lot of people who are sort of reflexively religious then start to associate non-belief and atheism with Satanism, and I mean Satanism isn't really a thing to me.
No, me either.
Yeah,
yeah, and I mean it would just to make it obvious, I mean, somebody who's an atheist would also reject Satanism.
Exactly.
So, right, exactly. Yeah. That was my thing that I would sort of struggle to articulate when I'm 13 years old and some classmate is saying, "Oh, no, you're a Satanist." I'm like, "I don't believe in your God. Why would I believe in your Satan?"
Because Satan darkened your soul.
Right, right.
And see, that's the thing, especially when you're 13 years old.
Right.
You know, when this is the culture you've been raised in, especially like a small town in the Shenandoah
right.
Valley, you know, this is everything that you know.
Right.
This is what you've been brought into.
It's the only game in town.
It's the only game in town. So the only way it can make sense is to sort of see things through
exactly.
that lens. The whole idea of, "Oh, you don't believe any of this," just doesn't fit
right.
with mm-hmm. their admittedly tiny little worldview. Mm-hmm. But then people go on to college. It was a little further back for me, but Scott, you're a recent graduate from UVA,
mm-hmm.
so perhaps you could speak about this meeting people from other walks of life, meeting people who maybe raised in small towns like Carolyn was.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that, the reason I'm even here is because I was part of the group at there, the VAA. But one of the things that I really did enjoy doing when I was in college was being able to meet people from those different walks of life.
Right.
So it wasn't just Christianity. It was also like Islam or Judaism or Buddhism or things like that. And I did find that very interesting, being able to talk to different groups of people about their different beliefs. And we were talking about this before the show started, about how, you know, depending on where you were born and how you were brought up, you'll have a totally different view on the religious, right? Like, you know, it's not just by chance that if someone was born in the Middle East, they're more likely to be Muslim than Christian.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that...
Or in the Midwest, they're more likely to be Christian.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. So...
Yeah. So, and that's the thing that I when I have these discussions with people, it's like, you know, if I have a discussion with someone who's, I don't know, let me pick one of the Christian religions, a Methodist, mm-hmm. you know, they have sort of very specific set of beliefs. I don't know what they are. But they're already atheistic when it comes to the other faiths.
Right.
So if you choose to be a Christian, then you don't believe in the Buddhist God, or you don't believe in the Muslim God, or any of the other... How many hundreds of religions do we
have?
Well,
I was just going to say, yeah. I mean, it's like, it's also like the idea of being atheist, even today, being atheist with respect to the gods of old, like the old Egyptian
right.
gods, the old Greek gods,
the old Norse gods.
Like, it's very yeah. easy to, I mean, we have movies that are caricatures of Thor.
Mm-hmm.
People used to believe that was the god of thunder in the Norse religions. You know what I mean? So it's very easy. When you take a look at it through that lens, to be like, oh, well, if this person is atheist with respect to these gods, like Zeus and Thor and stuff, then it'd be easy to understand how a Christian could be atheist with respect to the God of Islam and vice versa.
Right, right. So really the way I look at it is I just believe in one less God than you do.
Mm-hmm.
There's hundreds of gods that you don't believe in, and I just add one more to the list.
Right, and one of the ways that atheists differ from one another is that I'm realizing as we're having this conversation that, in fact, I do have a preferred label in a perfect world, and that's Protestant atheist.
Ooh. Mm. Oh, okay. All right. Carry on with that.
Yeah, so I never believed in Catholicism, and so all of these things like, I don't know, purgatory, things that might be legitimately very serious matters to someone who is a former Catholic, like meaning that it was formative to you, even if you don't still believe in it. That's not a piece of my atheism.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Protestant atheist. I'm very concerned about this free will thing.
Mm.
And not that a Catholic atheist wouldn't, but that because I had a Protestant understanding of it, that still informs how I think of these things.
So I'll ask you, do we have free will?
Ah, boy, long answer there. I think that we have a form of free will that, to use Dan Dennett's words, is worth having, but it is not this magical free will that the scholastics imagined was required for Christianity to be a sincere thing.
That was actually a very good answer.
Was it?
Yeah, it was. Do you have friends, perhaps you are who have at one point yourself, but do you have friends who say, well, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. And Scott, you nodded your head. What does that mean to you, and how much you respond to them? Get a little closer.
I was going to say, it's a good question because I have also asked that question when I've heard people say that.
Yes.
I have a lot of friends who they don't go to any sort of church or gatherings. They don't practice any of the regular things, but they call themselves spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Caroline was just talking about free will, and there's a really good author out there who I personally like by the name of Sam Harris.
Yes.
And he talks about free will, and he also has a book about spirituality. And so it is an interesting conversation that I think that's happening now, is that we're seeing a shift towards people who they want to get what you might call the spiritual side out of religious fulfillment without some of the beliefs that they can maybe discard, you know, and they think that don't really conform with reality. And so... I don't know. For me personally, the idea of spirituality, I don't know if I would consider myself that, but I'm much more open to the prospect of having that conversation about what it means for someone to be spiritual than if somebody tells me that they are like a fundamentally religious person or
sure.
something. It could be a little bit harder because just by the nature of what I already know about those religions.
You know what I mean? So to you, is spirituality, I don't know, like a lifestyle?
I guess it could be. I mean, when I think about it, I think of, this might sound very naive, but I think of things like meditation,
mm-hmm.
you know, and being, And for some reason, I think a lot more about Eastern traditions than I do about Western traditions.
Well, I think that's because in our society, people who are not comfortable with Western religious traditions and are drawn to the Eastern traditions are drawn to because of something sort of spirituality is not easily defined.
Right.
And I think a lot of people are not comfortable with saying they got nothing. I've known a number of people say, "Well, I'm spiritual in that I'm, you know, unlike you," is always the sort of implied statement. He said, "I'm open to these things." So I'll ask you, Carolyn, are you open to these things?
So I'd have to say probably not, in the sense that someone who endorses a spiritual but not religious stance probably is. I mean, I mean, I'm a materialist. I'm trained as a scientist.
Right.
I don't believe there's some extra layer to reality. And I also think that even if there were, that extra layer would be subject to all the same sets of questions that we now have about material processes, right? You were speaking of sort of the childhood animism of seeing the life in all the objects around you.
Yeah.
And that probably compares to very ancient human beliefs about living things with some form of agency in the world around us,
right?
But then with the advent of modern science, somehow suddenly, when we know the how of organisms do what they do, we experience a loss of some sort of a spiritual dimension to that. And then I'm not saying that that's sort of the genesis of the Western idea of God, but I think that that's an important piece of it. Then we want to invoke this God as being the thing that stands behind physical reality, and that somehow makes a difference. But if you examine that idea, I don't think it does what we want it to do. I don't think it really provides a deeper explanation. I think it would end up being problematic in all the same ways that our material explanations for things are.
So as someone with a scientific background, is science in opposition to religion?
That depends on what you mean by religion. You know, if you insist on believing in some kind of a mystical, this higher level of reality, you have to, in order to have both beliefs, in order to believe both in science and in some sort of mystical other reality, you have to accept that science simply can't answer any questions about this mystical reality.
Thank you. That's exactly the point. They're completely different questions. It's like, I don't know, art and... there is an art to cooking. It's like painting and cooking. you may be employing a similar part of the brain, a creative part of the brain, but the results are completely different. You're examining different things.
Right.
So is religion, but science is based on, is evidence based. You come up with a theory, you test the theory. If a theory can be repeated, then you can certify your results. Religion isn't like that. So is religion, and this is a trick question. I'm actually leading up to a point here, but is religion inherently irrational? Oh, I see you both gulping at that one. A little closer, Scott.
Well, I mean, I guess I would just say that. If we're taking rational to be, you know, evidence-based reason that gives us the proper reflection of reality,
right,
like what science does to give us the good picture, then you might say that someone's belief is irrational if they refuse to understand something in the face of evidence. You see what I mean?
Yes.
Like, you might be presented with evidence that contradicts your belief, but then you say, well, regardless of that, I'm going to believe this anyway, and that might be considered irrational. And I think that that can definitely happen a lot in religion.
So Carolyn,
okay,
yes, please.
Right. So I think, though, that then it gets unfair if you don't sort of own all of the ways that we have beliefs that are not susceptible to rational inquiry, right?
You're getting to my point ahead of me. Please continue.
Right. Like, I have a serious commitment philosophically, you know, to... You know, human lives are of equal dignity, of equal value. That's not something I can prove to you. And that's something that if I were to be strictly rational about advancing my own interests and the interests of my tribe, quote unquote,
right,
you can justify genocide. Now, I don't think genocide is actually justifiable under any circumstances. And I will own that that is not a rational belief on my part. That's something we might call transrational, saying that there are values that are important to us other than rationality.
And I think that we humans are inherently irrational creatures. Art is not rational. Music is not rational. Love. There may be sort of an evolutionary advantage.
Yeah, each of those things have a component of beauty, and beauty is something that moves us, something that we respond to.
Right.
And clearly, we couldn't do that if evolution hadn't fitted us for it.
And the the animals don't have that. I love my dog, but he doesn't really appreciate art. so there is something in us. There is something in us that connects to the world in a different way than our pets, than sort of the other life around us. I mean, there's no denying that our pets are our farm animals. That we're surrounded by life, but there is something about human beings that allows us to connect the world in a different way. We seek beauty, we seek connections, we make connections. So is there a scientific component? Is there something in the way that we're wired as neurological beings that makes us seek spirituality?
Do you want to speak to that, Scott? So I think... So other authors, and I've read people like Sam Harris and other sort of new atheists
right.
who've written about this, and I really like the idea that that our religious impulse, which is what we're talking about here, our impulse to see something larger, something that we can make a connection to or with, that is kind of that's something writ large that we need in order to interact with each other. We need to have kind of an intuitive grasp of the motives and the likely behaviors of the human beings around us. And the reason for this is, I mean, if you compare, a human being to any other top predator, we are weak and puny. But the thing we can do, we can run long distances, we can throw things with an overhand throw,
mm-hmm.
And we cooperate.
Right.
Right. Right. And we, in order to cooperate, we need to kind of, in my understanding of this, the way I think about it is we run a simulation in our minds, sort of in our consciousness, kind of at all times. We run a simulation of what are the motives, the likely behaviors of the persons all around us, mm-hmm. because those are the persons we need. We need them in order to bring down the wildebeest or whatever. And we also need to not piss them off and get ourselves ostracized, because a human being in the wilderness, we're dead. Right? And it's perhaps an artifact of that running a simulation that we then apply it to the whole world. And the thing is, we might even have started applying it to the whole world originally, that it makes sense to think of the weather as having things it wants,
mm-hmm.
if it allows you to predict the weather, right? It doesn't matter if the heuristic is right or wrong. What matters is the outcome. And it's the same thing with God, imagining that there is some great, big, enormous being out there that's in control of everything, and that you can propitiate it, right? Because that's what so much of our religious ritual is about. It's about bringing good outcomes and avoiding bad ones.
I was just going to add to that real quick. You were talking about intentional things. You mentioned Dan Dennett earlier, mm-hmm. and I was thinking about, read something where he said the idea of the intentional stance,
right.
and how we attribute the
intentional stance. I couldn't think of that.
We attribute intentions to certain animals and certain things. And I think that your explanation of why someone might come up with the idea of a God would be a really good one, because when you think about it, it's a lot more comfortable knowing the idea, why is there a drought? Oh, it's because we angered this guy in the sky, and that's why he didn't do this. It's a lot more comfortable when you know that, as opposed to someone just being like, oh, I have no idea. You know what I mean? And I think that can really, just help people get through certain things in that way.
Right. And it doesn't just help in the sense of, oh, I feel better now. It allows you to take action. Whereas the mm-hmm. horrendous level of existential anxiety you feel when you're confronted by the fact that you have no control over the drought, that's paralyzing.
Right.
So how do we get from that? Because I see we're going to have to do underwriting in just a minute, but I want to get this out because this thread is fascinating. How do we get from sort of an evolutionary advantage to people sort of coming together in sort of cooperative tribes to take down the wildebeest and believing that the world has intention? And I can see an advantage to that if you think that everything is out there to kill you,
right?
Then that's going to give you an evolutionary advantage to your buddy who doesn't believe that and, you know, walks out into the African belt,
atheist.
Right, and gets wiped out. How do we get from droughts are caused by our because we haven't pleased the gods, to when in a modern age where we have satellites, we understand meteorology, we understand continental drift. And yet, gays getting married cause hurricanes. You know what? We don't have an answer to that. So we will switch to underwriting one more here on. I haven't identified the show in a while. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
All right, so we live in a presumably secular society. We live in a nation that is governed by a constitution and a set of rules that we call laws. And there are certain things that we agree upon that are just better for society as a whole, like you can't murder other people, mm-hmm. and you have to respect property rights, and one man, one vote. So on paper, anyway, we are a secular society. And yet the United States, arguably the first democracy, the first democratic republic, the first a nation brought to, an intentional nation brought together by white men writing laws down on a piece of paper. We are also one of the most strangely religious societies. I mean, I have friends in Europe who look at what's going on over here, and they can't figure us out. Now, there are regions of the world which are being torn apart by religion. You know, we have Sunni and Shia Muslims, the what looks like the same religion to me, tearing each other apart and having genocide, genuine religious wars in parts of the world that we don't have control over. Okay, so here we sort of have, polite religious wars. but what is going on in our society? Is this, as I like to tell myself sometimes, kind of the last gasp of religiosity? Can religion coexist in a democracy? And how do you, Carolyn, and you, Scott, and me, Sean, how do we get by as secular people in a society that is not exactly the secular ideal?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind when I think about this is that I would just want to make it clear that, a person's beliefs in this realm, mm-hmm. they don't, like, I don't really care what somebody else thinks,
right.
in the sense that, like, you're free to believe whatever it is that you want. You know, that's one of the hallmarks of a free society.
We're American.
But the idea, though, that, in practice, that, or in theory, that sounds really good, but in practice, it's almost never the case that those beliefs don't eventually spill over into policy in some mm-hmm. way or another. And so my only concern with those kinds of things is when we see things like, the creationism and evolution, right? Like maybe not teaching or both teaching both or something like that, even though one has a lot more evidence in favor of it than the other, things
more
like
evidence.
That. Yeah. I'm trying to be, you know what I mean?
Evidence involved.
Yeah. But what I mean is that, like, I don't care what somebody believes, if they choose to believe something or whatever, but when it gets to a point where it can influence policy, that's when I have a little bit of a problem with it. So the idea that we can live in a society where people can believe whatever it is that they want is great. But it's also, the onus is on those people to make sure that, it doesn't eventually spill over into something that could be considered
into the public marketplace.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Carolyn, your thoughts?
Right. And I just think there's just a built-in tension there, particular to American-style sort of evangelical Christianity that's very focused on sort of that personal experience, the walk with Jesus and all like that, that this is how you show your faith, is you take it into the public marketplace. And so I think that the highest value has to be civility and civility is called for on both sides. And I think that often gets lobbed at us at atheists as if we're being uncivil And instead of sort of running the parallel and seeing that no.
Yes, and I will admit that sometimes I feel like I'm called upon to be more
to
civil.
To be more civil,
that the,
yes.
That the bar is a little higher
right.
here. Because, I don't know, when we, you know, I'm not from Virginia. And when I moved here and discovered that they actually teach the Bible in this school as literature, I don't know if they still do anymore. But 20 years ago, they did. I was a little appalled by that. But at least here in Charlottesville, where, you know, I think we've struck a good balance. But, you know, you hear someone say, well, you know, talk about, I don't know, prayer in school or prayer in football or football games. It was, I forget where this was, Texas. Probably that's kind of my
that
go-to state
like
where these things happen, where there was an assistant coach leading prayers for the players, and somebody brought it to the school board, and they said this has to stop. So, what is the right balance here? I mean, this is one of those situations like with the Bibles in the library. I don't really want a Satanist then
right.
to show up and lead a prayer at a football game because we're not trying to be the opposite of.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think I really sort of admire it just for sheer amusement value. I'm not saying I think that this is a good idea, but I do kind of, I'm very amused by the trolling tactics
yes.
of
yeah.
you know, Satanism. That's just, yeah. it's like, well, shoes on the other foot now.
Right, and I think the real idea there is to bring the conversation up out
right.
of kind of the
right,
you
right,
know.
Right. Because I think the thing that really drives a lot of this sort of pushing religion back into public spaces is there's this belief that Christian faith is synonymous with decent moral behavior,
exactly.
and it's deeply ingrained.
Yes, mm-hmm.
and it's as if so many believers can't even question it. This is part of why, you know, when 13-year-old Caroline, I didn't even pop myself out as an atheist. Someone said something that I found profoundly ignorant about the theory of evolution in the locker room one day.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, no, it's not a theory that we came from monkeys. It's that we share a common ancestor with the other great apes. And all of a sudden, Caroline's a Satanist. and it was, it's very funny because prior to me being talked about all over the school as a Satanist who probably did horrible, horrible things, I had been regarded as this unacceptably goody two-shoes sort.
Do you have any good baby recipes? Do you prefer them roasted or boiled?
Right. Yeah, things like that.
So,
I mean,
well, let me just ask you. Are you a moral person?
Of course.
Scott?
Yeah,
Are you a moral person? Do you lead a moral
yes.
life?
Mm-hmm.
But would an evangelical Christian think that we lead moral lives?
Well, I mean, you know, my first reaction to that is just like, well, who are they to judge?
Right.
You
right.
know? Like
right.
what endows them with like the moral authority that the rest of us should all abide by, you know, in that case. And I think that goes back to what you were saying is, well, if you want to go.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, 14-year-old Caroline growing up in the same culture as everybody else, you know, and receiving those notions of sin and everything like that and being so concerned with becoming a good person and doing the right thing. And religion's the only game in town. And the thing that evangelical Christianity gives you is a belief that because you believe in Jesus, you're on the right side.
Right.
Right.
And I was just going to say, yeah. And if anything, I feel like that can in its own way be almost more detrimental than not, because there's that great quote that says, like, you know, I forget who it's by, but says something about, you know, in order for good people to do bad things, you need like religion, you know, in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that might be a little bit of a strong claim, but it is true to an extent that just because, like what you said, you believe in Jesus, as an example, doesn't mean that that makes you like a moral person. It's like your actions, the actions that you take make you a moral person, which is why I don't think that you need religion or any belief in that in order to be a good person. It's just how you act towards other people.
Right, and I would broaden that, what's necessary for evil, to get good people to do bad things is religion, and I would broaden that a bit and say ideology.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I mean, I definitely understand, I empathize even if I do not sympathize with the sort of comfort that religion can bring. I was talking to a friend of mine last night, and I discovered that his sister-in-law passed away unexpectedly, just like this week. He was just at the funeral. She was in her 40s. She had kids. Goodness. I mean, yeah, it's terrible, right? And, you know, and what do you say at a moment like that? In this one sense, I admire people who have religion because they have, so they have dogma for that. They know what to say.
Right.
I don't know what to say. And he started talking about his sister-in-law, and he said that it was a blessing. In the past year and a half or so, she had rediscovered Jesus, and she had rededicated her life to that, and that she was spreading the word. And so he felt good about that. That, you know, and that, you know, before she died, you know, she had this opportunity to do this blessed thing. And all I could do was just kind of nod and go, "That's great." Right? I mean, and it really is.
You know, right,
this
it
was,
is.
This was clearly so important to him and to his family.
Right, right. And I would say the blessing there is that she found something meaningful
right.
to be doing with what she didn't know were the last months of her life.
Yeah, yeah. But as a secular person, as a non-believer, I'm terrible at things like funerals and terrible at, because I don't have a, if there's one thing I feel like missing, it's sort of like this set of rules for dealing with some of these major and often unexpected life events. And I totally get, I mean, a few years ago, my best friend passed away.
Oh,
cancer.
Sorry.
Oh, thank you. And it wasn't, it wasn't entirely unexpected. He had cancer, run a treatments. He seemed to be getting better. And then it came back and he chose not to have the second round of
right.
treatments. And, you know, he made this choice and he passed away. And even though I don't believe in an afterlife, even though I don't really believe I'll ever see him again, I started comforting myself with imagining that I would. And we worked together for many years. We worked together at UVA. You know, I would walk through the grounds. I would come across a spot where I remembered that he and I had had a conversation together, and I would sense his presence. I would feel him there. And even though the rational part of my brain was saying, "Dude, this is your imagination," the other side of my brain was saying, "That's cool."
Right.
Let yourself have this moment. Let yourself feel this. And, you know, I visited his grave. I've talked to him. And I'm doing it for me, not because I rationally believe that he's out there and he's sensing this and he's appreciating this. But he's a part of my life. And he's still a part of my life.
Right.
So I totally get, and I'm even a little jealous of people who can actually hold on to this as a belief. There have been moments in your life like that where you, I see you're both nodding,
right.
where you feel like, yeah, it would be nice to have that. You're nodding, but you don't
want
to talk about
Well, and that's the thing, is that this, I mean, this approach is very personal territory. We're talking about loss here,
yes.
You know, and how we deal with it. And yeah, that's very true. I have, at this point in my life, I'm not that old, but I've lost some people who just were so foundational to me. And the notion that the world goes on when they're gone is just so hard.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
Right.
I was going to say, yeah, in a similar vein, I feel the same way in the sense that it is, you know, losing people is one of the hardest things that you can possibly happen to you in life, you know? And so, I don't know. It is difficult in those moments, but I like one of the things that you said that I liked was that you said you were doing it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, I think that's totally reasonable at the end of the day to say that you are doing something like that for your own well-being, to allow those thoughts to congeal in your mind and keep the memory of that person alive, for your own well-being, to not forget who they are, not forget the things they taught you, not forget the experiences you shared with them. And I think that's, I think that's totally reasonable and a healthy thing, because that's how those people really can live on. It's in the minds of the people who they touched when they were alive. And that's how I see it.
Right. And I, Scott has now brought it back to something I feel like I can speak to, which is you were mentioning sort of the things people say at funerals and how that is informed by, you were saying they have dogma for this. They have lines.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we do have lines, right? But they're lines. And the thing that you can bring, and I'm not saying that people who are religious are not sincere in this, but as an atheist, you kind of show up as your own damn self, you know?
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And so what you say is, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I feel you. And
yeah.
I share your loss.
Yeah.
And let's talk about so-and-so.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or if that's not appropriate, you know, let's go out for a walk, you know, whatever. It puts you in a place where you have to be emotionally real with the other people who are grieving. You don't get to fall back on platitudes. And again, I'm not saying that that's what religious people do as some sort of a categorical thing. I'm not. But since we don't have language with it, what we have to do is have a real relationship that's us, our personal selves, with the other people in our life. And I think that this is one of the things that, this is part of why religion, to the extent that it's damaging, is so damaging, because it substitutes a God when what you need is human connection.
Yeah, yeah. So my dad passed away a couple of years ago after my friend passed away, and oddly, I was better prepared for it, even though it was less, we didn't have as much warning. It wasn't a big surprise when he passed. And people would come to me, and fortunately, my friends who know me, even if they're religious, I would actually see them sort of squirm a little bit. Like, they don't quite know what to say, you know. Normally, you have your platitudes you can fall back on. Well, he's in a better place.
Right.
he's buried in there. Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, it's a better place.
Yeah, we scattered his ashes in the San Francisco Bay. Right. That's a great place to be, you know. How do you, you know, so we have those moments right there where we don't have rules. But we also just have, I don't know, it's Easter right now. Holidays, Christmas. People wish you Merry Christmas. They wish you a blessed Easter. How do you deal with that? How kind of in your face do you want to be with those sort of things?
I just think that this is such a softball. Those people are just wishing you well.
Exactly.
Why in the world would you, you know, say, you know, put your fist in their eye? I mean, why, you know?
Right. So I'm not offended if a store hangs up a banner that says Merry Christmas.
Right.
On the other hand, if they hang up a banner that says Happy Holidays, then they instruct, you know, their workers to say Happy Holidays so they're not being denominational. I think that's kind of great.
Right.
I think they're being
inclusive.
More inclusive.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you've got these religious freedom laws and these religious restoration laws in various states. There was one yesterday. Where was it? One of those flyover states where now they're codified laws that allow business owners to not serve customers if they find their sexual identity to be offensive to them.
I kind of thought this was the thing that went down in whichever Carolina. I apologize to all Carolinians who might be listening. North Carolina, all right.
North, okay.
Which was that, of course, North Carolina, which is actually has very, you know, plenty of progressive little areas in it.
Right.
Where cities were passing local ordinances to prohibit that kind of discrimination. And the legislature called a special session to put the kibosh on all that.
Right, right. And it's become a thing in this election cycle,
right,
just like marriage equality was a few years ago. And by the way, I think that the Supreme Court decided on marriage equality precisely because all those regional, local, state elections a few years before, which were trying to put sort of
amendments
in one way or another
to just prohibit it.
To prohibit it, what they call it, traditional marriage, kind of brought it to the fore. So now these regional legislators, state legislators that are bringing these religious freedom laws to the fore, part of me is saying, yeah, go right ahead. Because now we're going to start discussing this on a national level.
Right.
And I think nationally, people are generally for being more inclusive.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you just have, there's a remnant of people who know that they're aging out. And they're scared.
Yeah.
And they're clinging to whatever little piece of you know, social control they feel like they have. It's the same thing as when I was coming up in the 90s and being involved in this Christian community. Couldn't understand the hatred for gay people. It's like, what in the world does it matter to you?
Yeah.
Right.
Right? And it's, and the thing is, it's not even about the gays. These people aren't even people in that sort of conception. It's about a tribalism. It's asserting an identity. Well, I'm against that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I warned you before the show started that the hour was going to go by faster than you realized. And guess what? The hour has gone by. So Scott Skakowski.
You got it.
I got it. And Carolyn Flournoy, thank you very much. Do you have last parting shots that you want to give before we close the show?
I just want to say thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you, Sean.
Well, thank you both for being our guest. You've been listening to The Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.